memoirs. After three revolutions of the Earth, as we finished running the checklist for our translunar injection, Steve Wong's tummy finally settled down. Somewhere over Africa, we opened the valves in the translunar motor, the hypergolics worked their chemical magic, and whoosh, we were hauling the mail to Moonberry RFD, our escape velocity a crisp 7 miles per second, Earth getting smaller and smaller in the window. The Americans who went to the moon before us had computers so primitive that they couldn't get email or use Google to settle arguments. The iPads we took had something like 70 billion times the capacity of those Apollo-era dial-ups and were mucho handy, especially during all the downtime on our long haul. M-Dash used his to watch the final season of Girls. We took hundreds of selfies with the Earth in the window, and, plinking a ping-pong ball off the center seat, played a tableless table tennis tournament, which was won by Anna. I worked the attitude jets in pulse mode, yawing and pitching the Allen bean for views of some of the few stars that were visible in the naked sunlight. Antares, Nunki, the globular cluster NGC 6333, none of which twinkle when you're up there among them. The big event of translunar space is crossing the equigravisphere, a boundary as invisible as the international dateline, but, for the Allen bean, the Rubicon. On this side of the EQS, Earth's gravity was tugging us back, slowing our progress, bidding us to return home to the life-affirming benefits of water, atmosphere, and a magnetic field. Once we crossed, the moon grabbed hold, wrapping us in her ancient silvery embrace, whispering to us to hurry, 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 to wink in wonder at her magnificent desolation. At the exact moment that we reached the threshold, Anna awarded us origami cranes made out of aluminum foil, which we taped onto our shirts like pilot's wings. I put the Allen bean into a passive thermal control BBQ roll, our moon-bound ship rotating on an invisible spit so as to distribute the solar heat. Then we dimmed the lights, taped a sweatshirt over the window to keep the sunlight from sweeping across the cabin, and slept, each of us curled up in a comfortable nook of our little rocket ship. When I tell people that I've seen the far side of the moon, they often say, "You mean the dark side?" As though I'd fallen under the spell of Darth Vader or Pink Floyd. In fact, both sides of the moon get the same amount of sunshine, just on different shifts. Because the moon was waxing gibbous to the folks back home, we had to wait out the shadowed portion on the other side. In that darkness, with no sunlight and the moon blocking the Earth's reflection, I pulsed the Allen bean around so that our window faced outbound for a view of the infinite time-space continuum that was worthy of IMAX, unblinking stars in subtle hues of red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, our galaxy stretching as far as our eyes were wide, a diamond blue carpet against a black that would have been terrifying had it not been so mesmerizing. Then there was light, snapping on as if M-Dash had flipped a switch. I tweaked the controls, and there below us was the surface of the moon. Wow. Gorgeous, in a way that strained any use of the word. A rugged place that produced ooze and awe. The Luna ticket app, 99 cents, showed us traversing south to north, but we were mentally lost in space. The surface as chaotic as a wind-blown gray-capped bay, until I matched the Poincaré impact basin with a "This is our moon" guide on my Kobo. The Allen bean was soaring 153 kilometers high, 95.06 miles Americanus, at a speed faster than that of a bullet from a gun, and the moon was slipping by so fast that we were running out of far side. Oresby Crater had white, finger-painted streaks. Heva's side showed rills and depressions like river washouts. We split Dufay right in half, a flyover from its 6 to its 12, the rim a steep, sharp razor. Mare Moscoviense was far to port, a mini-version of the Ocean of Storms, where 4.5 decades ago the real Alan Bean spent 2 days hiking, collecting rocks, taking photos. Lucky man. Our brains could only take in so much, so our iPhones did the recording, and I stopped calling out the sights, though I did recognize Campbell and D'Alembert, large craters linked by the smaller Slipher, just as we were about to head home over the moon's north pole. Steve Wong had queued up a certain musical track for what would be Earthrise, but had to reboot the Bluetooth on Anna's jambox and was nearly late for his cue. M-Dash yelled, "Hit play, hit play!" just as a blue and white patch of life, a slice of all that we have made of ourselves, all that we have ever been, pierced the black cosmos above the sawtooth horizon. I was expecting something classical. Franz Joseph Haydn or George Harrison. But the circle of life from the Lion King scored our home planet's rise over the plaster of Paris moon. Really? A Disney show tune? But you know, that rhythm and that chorus and the double meaning of the lyrics caught me right in the throat, and I choked up. Tears popped off my face and joined the others' tears, which were floating around the Alan Bean. Anna gave me a hug, like I was still her boyfriend. We cried. We all cried. You'd have done the same. Coasting home was one fat anticlimax, despite the never-spoken possibility of our burning up on reentry like an obsolete spy satellite circa 1962. Of course, we were all chuffed, as the English say, that we'd made the trek and maxed out the memory on our iPhones with iPhotos. But questions arose about what we were going to do upon our return, apart from making some bitchin' posts on Instagram. If I ever run into Al Bean again, I'll ask him what life has been like for him since he twice crossed the equigravisphere. Does he suffer melancholia on a quiet afternoon, as the world spins on automatic? Will I occasionally get the blues because nothing holds a wonder equal to splitting Dufay down the middle? TBD, I suppose. "Whoa, Kamchatka!" Anna called out as our heat shield expired into millions of grain-sized comets. We were arcing down over the Arctic Circle, gravity once again commanding that we who went up must come down. When the chute pyro shot off, the Alan Bean jolted our bones, causing the jambox to lose its duct tape purchase and conk M-Dash in the forehead. By the time we splashed down off Oahu, a trail of blood was running from the ugly gash between his eyebrows. Anna tossed him her bandana, because guess what no one had thought to take around the moon? To anyone reading this with plans to imitate us, band-aids. At Stable One, that is, bobbing in the ocean rather than having disintegrated into plasma, M-Dash tripped the Rescue Us flares that he'd rigged under the parachute jettison system. I opened the pressure equalizing valve a tad early, and oops, noxious fumes from the excess fuel burn-off were sucked into the capsule, making us even queasier, what with the mal de mer. Once the cabin pressure was at the same PSI as outside, Steve Wong was able to uncork the main hatch, and the Pacific Ocean breeze whooshed in, as soft as a kiss from Mother Earth. But owing to what turned out to be a huge design flaw, that same Pacific Ocean began to join us in our spent little craft. The Alan Bean's second historic voyage was going to be to Davy Jones's locker. Anna, thinking fast, held aloft our Apple products, but Steve Wong lost his Samsung, the Galaxy, ha, which disappeared into the lower equipment bay as the rising seawater bade us exit. The day boat from the Kahala Hilton, filled with curious snorkelers, pulled us out of the water. the English speakers on board telling us that we smelled horrid, the foreigners giving us a wide berth. After a shower and a change of clothes, I was ladling fruit salad from a decorative dugout canoe at the hotel buffet table when a lady asked me if I had been in that thing that came down out of the sky. Yes, I told her. I had gone all the way to the moon and returned safely to the surly bonds of Earth, just like Alan Bean. Who's Alan Bean? She said. Our Town Today with Hank Vasey. At Loose in the Big Apple. New York City. On my own for 3 days, as my wife let me tag along, as she celebrated her 25th college reunion with her sorority sisters of Gotta Get a Guy. I had not been to the Isle of Manhattan since Cats was on B-Way and hotel TVs were not high def. So, what's new in New York? Too much, if you have fond memories of the place, but little if the naked city leaves you feeling, well, naked. I think NYC comes off way better on TV and in the movies, when a taxi is just a whistle away, and superheroes save the day. In the real world, ours, every day in Gotham is a little like the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and a lot like baggage claim after a long, crowded flight. Hitting the streets of the big town ASAP is a requirement, especially when the missus takes the family credit history off to all those big stores with one name. Bergdorf's, Goodman's, Saks, Bloomie's, not a one of which is any better than our own Henworthy's, which has been open at 7th and Sycamore since 1952. For my money, a dwindling supply, those fancy places charge too much just for shopping bags. But give NYNY this, walking those streets is a show unto its own. I mean, where is everyone going? Central Park, maybe? That big rectangle of greenery has more musicians than the East Valley High School marching band. But they're all solo acts. Those sax blowers, horn players, violinists, accordion squeezers, and at least one Japanese samisen musician are all in competition with the fellow starving musical artist who performs a few yards away, making for a funky fugue that mars the relative peace of the park. Add in hundreds of serious joggers, power walkers, cyclists, an equal number of lollygaggers, tourists on rental bikes, tricycles towing passengers, and the horses and buggies that make the park smell of a petting zoo, and you'll yearn for our own Spitz Riverside Park, with less postcard views, true, but at least our Tri-City squirrels look a lot happier. On foot, you cross the park from the east side streets, tall with former tycoon mansions, to the west side avenues, jammed with Starbucks, The Gap, and Bed Bath & Beyond. Had I just stumbled into our own Hillcrest Mall in Pierman? Looked like it, but where was the convenient parking? Not without magic is Metropolis, a.k.a. New York City, I admit. When the sun drops behind the towers and stops baking the pavement, it's nice to cool one's heels at a curbside table with a cocktail in your fist. That's when Yankee Town has the charm of our own Country Market patio bar and grill. I sat and sipped and watched as a world of Knickerbocker oddballs strolled by. I saw a man with a cat on his shoulders, European tourists in the tightest pants imaginable, a team of firemen pull up in an engine, go into a high-rise apartment, only to come out later talking about a bad smoke detector, a man rolling a homemade telescope up the street, the actor Kiefer Sutherland walked by, and a woman with a big white bird on her shoulder. Hope she avoided the guy with a cat. A Caesar salad is the true test of any hotel restaurant. Write that down. Our own Sun Garden Red Lion Inn at the airport serves a beauty. But at a Times Square eatery, pre-theater dinner with a wife and still foxy co-eds, my salad was limp and the dressing too tart. Hell, Caesar. After I picked up the check, The girls headed off to see the B-Way production of Chicago. Like the movie, but without the close-ups. I don't know much about musical theater, but I bet cash money what the girls saw that night was not any better than the Meadow Hills Community College Drama Department's production of Roaring Twenty-Somethings, which went to the American College Theater Festival last year. Does the Great White Way beat out the best of the Tri-Cities? Not according to this reporter. If you're hungry and crave a frankfurter, they're for sale all over Manhattan, on street corners, every few yards in the park, in subway stations, with papaya juice. None of them beat a tube steak from Butterworth's Hot Dog Emporium on Grand Lake Drive. A bagel in Manhattan is the stuff of theologians, but Crane's West Side Cafeteria serves up a heavenly leavened bun to all in the Tri-Cities. Much is made of New York, New York-style pizza, but I fork my money over for a slice of La Monica's Neapolitan, and yes, they deliver within a 10-mile circle of each of their 14 locations. And speaking of Italian food, Anthony's Italian Cellar in Harborview has all the authenticity of any joint in Little Italy without the mobster rubouts. Anything New York has that we lack in our own Tri-Cities? Not so much. Since TV gives us all the sports and media in the world, and the Internet provides all else. I admit the multitude of museums on Manhattan is fine, dandy, impressive, etc. Being able to walk into, say, an ancient temple from Dendur or a hall full of assembled dinosaur bones makes for a great excursion, even when you have to share it with school kids from all over the state and tourists from all over the world. I had a whole day of museums when the women booked facials, massages, and pedicures, a.k.a. hangover cures. I saw paintings I will never understand, an installation that was nothing more than a room filled with torn-up carpet samples, and a sculpture that looked like a huge, rusted, dented refrigerator. Ars gratia artis, art for art's sake, moaned the MGM lion. My final museum was the place for modern art, where I saw a movie that was nothing more than time passing. Really, a lot of clocks ticking and people looking at their watches. I gave it 10 minutes. Upstairs, there was a blank canvas with a knife slice down its middle. Another canvas was colored a light blue at the bottom that became a dark blue at the top. In the stairwell, an actual helicopter was hanging from the ceiling, a whirly bird frozen in flight. Up the steps, a pair of Italian typewriters, large and small versions of the same model, were kept behind glass as if they were studded with valuable gems, but they weren't. Nor were the machines more than 50 years old. I couldn't help but think the Tri-Cities could put together a collection of used typewriters and charge admission. The now vacant Baxter's Hand Factory on Wyatt Boulevard is available. Anyone civic-minded enough to get cracking on that? Who's Who? On a Monday morning in early November of 1978, as she had been every day for the past 6 weeks, Sue Glebe was up and out of the apartment before her roommates were awake. Rebecca was asleep, 8 feet off the floor in the loft bed in the living room, and Shelley, probably, was still conked out behind the locked door of the apartment's single bedroom. Sue had showered quickly and quietly in the half-tub, with the rubber hose running up from the faucet, the dribbling water a weak stream that was alternately tepid and then as hot as the surface of the planet Mercury. Since she had come to New York, she had yet to feel truly clean, and her scalp had begun to itch. She dressed in the fog of the tiny bathroom, slipped on her shoes from under the living room sofa where she slept, strapped her big leather purse crossways from shoulder to opposite hip, then grabbed the umbrella she had bought on Friday. Another storm was due, the news said, and Sue was prepared. She had already paid $5 of her dollars to one of the many men who appeared with boxes of umbrellas the moment the clouds grew thick with rain. As quietly as possible, Sue exited through the front door, making sure the lock clicked behind her. She had once failed to confirm that click, and Shelley had angrily lectured her on the dangers of an unlocked apartment door in New York City in 1978. No click was a major no-no. Her roommates had come to view her as an unexorcised poltergeist, one that had to be negotiated around. Then again, they were not really her roommates, but her hosts, making Sue feel as welcome as an abdominal parasite. Rebecca had been so friendly the last summer when she was working costumes for the Arizona Civic Light Opera, and Sue, a local hire, was playing three featured roles. They were gal pals then. On days when her duties were slack, Rebecca swam in the pool at the Glebe family home and partied with the company on the Glebe patio. She had offered Sue her couch for a while, whenever, if ever, she came to New York City. When Sue showed up with three suitcases, $800 in savings and a dream, Rebecca's actual roommate, Shelley, nodded her assent to the deal with a, yeah, okay. But that was 7 weeks ago, and Sue was still spending every night on the couch in the small living room. The vibes in the one-bedroom apartment just off Upper Broadway had gone from benign hospitality to Arctic-level icy cold. Rebecca wanted Sue out. Shelley wanted her dead. Sue hoped to purchase extra sofa time and goodwill with contributions of $50 to the rent, as well as providing milk, Tropicana orange juice, and once a thing called blackout cake that Shelley ate for breakfast. Such gestures were not so much appreciated as expected. What could Sue do? Where could Sue go? She was hunting for her own New York City apartment every single day, but the agency's named apartment finders and West Side Spaces had listings that were in dark, urine-stained tenements where no one answered the buzzer, or were no longer available, or never existed in the first place. Shelley told her to post a need a roommate notice on the board at Actors Equity, but Sue confessed that she had yet to join the union. She couldn't until she had an acting job. Shelley gave her a half-lidded look of supreme disappointment, and another, yeah, okay. Then added, next time you go to ShopRite, get a big can of Chock Full of Nuts, please. In this eighth week, the start of her third month on the Isle of Manhattan, the bundle of Arizona talent who had played Maria in West Side Story just last season at the ACLO was prone to weeping at night, silently in her bedroll on the couch, in the diamond-shaped silhouettes made by the window's security gates. Were such things actually burglar-proof? On the subway, which cost her 50 cents a ride, she often fought back tears, worried that someone would see a pretty young girl undone by her struggles and, well, rob her, or worse. For Sue, moving to New York was an act of faith, faith in herself, in her talent, and in the promise of the city that never slept. It was supposed to be an adventure, like something out of the movies, where she would come out of a stage door after a performance and kiss a handsome sailor on shore leave. Or a TV show like That Girl, where she'd have an apartment with a big kitchen and louvered shutters and a boyfriend who worked for Newsview magazine. But New York was not cooperating. How could things be going so sadly for Sue Glebe, who was the very definition of a triple threat? She could sing, dance, and act. Her parents had recognized her raw talent when she was a little girl. She had starred in all the high school plays. She had been selected from the chorus at the Civic Light Opera to become their lead actress for three seasons running. She had done high-button shoes with Monty Hall, the host of TV's Let's Make a Deal. She had a going-away party with a big banner reading, On to Broadway. So why was New York, New York making her cry? Her first night in the city, when Rebecca took her via the bus to see Lincoln Center, Sue had looked at all the locals along Upper Broadway and actually asked, "Where's everyone going?" She now knew that everyone was going everywhere. This morning, she was going to the bank. the manufacturer's Hanover branch, where she had opened an account 5 weeks before. From behind a plexiglass, bulletproof wall, a disinterested female teller slid a $10 bill, a fiver, and five ones through a slot, leaving it to Sue to note that her savings were now down to exactly $564. She had spent more than $200 in New York City and had nothing to show for it but a five-buck umbrella, a blue one with a telescoping handle. From the bank, Sue went to a donut shop for one plain cake, which was the least expensive, and a coffee with sugar in half and half. That was breakfast. She ate standing at a counter, sticky from bits of sugar glaze and spilled Java. Barely fortified, she walked to the office of Apartment Finders on Columbus Avenue, which was up a wide flight of stairs and above a Hunan Chinese restaurant. The posted listings on the wall had not changed since Saturday, but Sue searched the bulletin board anyway, for a diamond chipped off a ring, for an overlooked gem, for a place with her name on it. Apartment Finders had cost her $50 a month, money she might as well have used to light candles. She would come back later in the day when supposedly new listings were posted, but she already knew her hopes were sure to be dashed again. Sue decided she was adapting to Gotham, because she turned on her heel and headed back over to Broadway with an agenda for the day. She would not blow time by idly walking in Central Park with its weedy lawns and cracked benches, dirty sandlots, and pathways littered with discarded coffee cups, spent condoms, and other trash. She would not filter through the record stores and bookstores without buying any of the titles. She would not spend money on the trade papers, Showbiz, Backstage, or Daily Variety, looking for notices of Equity principal interviews or auditions for non-Equity showcases. Not today. Today she was going to the public library, the famous building at 42nd and 5th, the landmark building with the stone lions in front. Two blocks from the 86th Street subway station, the rain started. Sue halted, reached for her umbrella, pushed the button on the telescoping handle, but the handle did not telescope. She pulled on the fabric of the thing, forcing it open, but in doing so, bent some of the spokes. When she tried to slide the plastic knob up the shaft, the umbrella bent like the leg of a card table. She shook the umbrella and tried forcing the knob, but only half of the cover deployed. With the rain getting heavy, she re-cocked and again tried to get the umbrella open, but inverted into a scoop and more of the spokes disconnected like severed ribs. Giving up, she tried to jam the worthless skeleton into an overflowing trash bin at Broadway and 88th, but the umbrella seemed to fight back, refusing to go in with the other garbage. It took her four tries before it stayed put. She hurried to the subway station. Her hair was dripping from the rain as she stood in line at the kiosk to purchase the two tokens she would need for the day's travels. The local trains were delayed, a flood on the uptown tracks. The crowd grew on the platform, large enough that Sue was edged ever closer to the yellow safety line. One bump, and she could have fallen onto the tracks. 40 minutes later, she was standing in a subway car so crowded the riders were crammed against each other, their body heat making steam rise from their heavy, rain-soaked coats. The car was so stuffy and hot, Sue began sweating. At Columbus Circle, the car stopped and did not move for 10 minutes. The doors jammed shut, preventing escape. Finally, at Times Square, Sue pushed herself out of the car and into the stream of people who had managed to find the stairs. She tramped up and up and through the turnstiles, then up more stairs and out into the chaos of the crossroads of the world where everybody was going everywhere. Times Square was an exterior version of the station below, filthy, flooded, and overcharged with people. Sue had learned a primary lesson since her arrival in the city: to keep moving, to walk with purpose even when she had none, especially along 42nd Street, dodging the human debris that collected there for the drugs, the porn, and in the rain to peddle $5 umbrellas. She'd navigated the area before, seeking appointments at the lesser talent agencies. Those with offices close by the Big X where Broadway crossed 7th Avenue. She had been surprised to find normal people at normal desks doing normal business just floors above the hissing concrete of Times Square. She had no luck with any of the agents. She never made it past the outer offices, so was reduced to leaving her resume with secretaries who would say, "Yeah, okay," in a tone remarkably similar to her temporary co-host Shelley's. On this Monday, her agenda was her resume. During the last month in Scottsdale, Sue had done two TV commercials for Valley Home Furniture, sweeping her arms wide, exclaiming, "Every room, every style, every budget." Then, for four weekends, she had acted at the Autumnal Renaissance Fair, quoting Shakespeare as a lusty wench for $30 a day. She had added those credits to her resume with a ballpoint pen, but she knew it looked, well, amateurish. So she was going to retype the whole thing, get an offset printer to make 100 copies, then staple one each to the backs of her headshots, the photo that made her look like Cheryl Ladd from Charlie's Angels, but with real cleavage. The problem was that she had no typewriter, nor did Rebecca. When Sue asked Shelley if she had a machine she could use, she didn't say no, but did tell her they rent them at the library. That's why Sue Glebe was umbrella-less, navigating eastward on 42nd Street, passing a stoned-looking teenager who had pulled his penis out of his pants and was pissing as he stumbled along. Not a single person made note of the sight. The exact moment Sue discovered that the main library was closed on Mondays, a flash of lightning bleached the scraped sky of mid-Manhattan. She stood at the side entrance to the landmark building, its door locked, unable to comprehend the meaning of those three simple words, "closed on Mondays." Just as a roll of thunder outblared the honking horns of traffic, she lost the battle against tears, the collective disappointments simply too much. New York City roommates were not friendly soul sisters. Central Park was a place of naked trees, unusable benches, and spent rubbers. Windows had security gates that locked rapists out and victims in. No cute sailors were waiting to meet a girl and get a kiss. No. In New York City, real estate parlors took your money and lied to you. Drug addicts relieved themselves in plain sight. And the public library was closed on Mondays. Sue was crying right there on 42nd Street between 5th Avenue and 6th, or according to the map, the Avenue of the Americas. Sobbing, gasping, tears, the big show. As many people as had made note of the stone guy's penis stopped to help or even look at the girl who was having so terrible a day that she was weeping aloud in public. Until, "Sue Glebe?" a man's voice called out. "You little titmouse?" Bob Roy was the only man in the world who called her a titmouse. Bob Roy had been the general business manager of the ACLO, but lived in New York City. He was a theater professional, contracted for the season, and a homosexual. He had once been an actor on Broadway, and he'd done commercials in the 1960s, but went into theater management for steady work. Running the Civic Light Opera out west was a summer camp for him. He did it every year and took his duties a little less seriously than he did laughing and gossiping. Bob Roy seemed to know everything about the theater, and if you worked in his company, if he signed your paychecks, he either loved you or loathed you. Your treatment completely depended on which way his judgmental wind blew. He loved Sue Glebe from the moment he saw her at a dress rehearsal for Brigadoon in the summer of 76. He delighted in her youth, her halo of honey blonde hair, her clear eyes full of good nature, and her conscientious work ethic. He adored her for showing up on time, knowing her lines, and having ideas for her onstage business. He was fascinated by her tanned body and firm boobs and her lack of self-consciousness, ego, and spite. Every straight man, all seven of them at the ACLO, wanted to fuck her. But she wasn't that way. Most actresses craved such adoration and demanded the largest dressing room, but Sue Glebe wanted nothing more than to be on stage. After three seasons, she had not changed a whit, and Bob Roy loved her all the more. He was in a taxi at the curb. The window rolled down with the rain falling between them. "Get in this cab right now," he ordered. He slid over to make room for her, and the cab moved along. "I'd have bet on seeing Ava Gabor on 42nd Street before you. Are you crying?" "No." "Yes." "Oh, Bobby." Sue explained. She had been in the city for 2 months, sleeping on Rebecca's couch. Her savings were running out. No agents would give her the time of day. She saw a man pissing in the street. She was crying now, in particular, because the only movies that told the truth about New York City were about needle parks and taxi drivers on killing sprees. Bob Roy laughed out loud. "You've been in New York for 2 months and haven't called me?" "Naughty, Sue. Naughty, naughty. I didn't have your number." "What were you doing in Slime Square?" "Going to the library." "To check out the latest Nancy Drew mysteries? I'd have guessed you'd read them all by now." "They have typewriters. I need to create a new resume." "Titmouse," Bob said. "Start with a new you first. How about a cup of tea or hot postum, whatever soothed baby Sue growing up in Indian country?" The taxi took them to Bob's apartment downtown, to a terrible neighborhood where all the buildings were six-story tenements and the sidewalks were lined with beaten-up trash cans. He gave the driver $6 and asked for no change. She followed him out into the rain, up the stoop, through the heavy main door, then four flights up a narrow, zigzagging stairway to apartment 4D. He needed keys for three different locks on the door. From the dingy, dimly lit hallway, the walls more dirty gray than the original green, the floor a maze of broken and mismatched tiles, Sue stepped into a haven that smelled of candles and lemon-scented dish soap, a cabinet of curiosities, one of which was the bathtub smack dab in the middle of the small kitchen. Bob Roy's railroad flat was four tight, connected rooms, each stuffed with kumbis, knick-knacks, doodads, furniture pieces of any style, shelves, books, photos and frames, trophies bought from flea markets, old records, small lamps, and calendars from decades before. "I know," he said. "It looks like I sell magic potions in here, like I'm an animated badger from a Disney cartoon." He lit a burner on the stove with a huge kitchen match, then filled a shiny, old English-style kettle with water from the tap. As he prepared cups on a tray, he said, "10 minutes, Titmouse, make a home for yourself." The room off the kitchen was really a hallway, a narrow passage through treasures and cast-offs. The sitting room featured three large chairs of different eras, one a lazy boy, each covered with a colorful throw of some kind. A circular coffee table, nearly too large for the square space, was covered with stacks of books, a cigar box full of sharpened pencils, a vase with an artificial orchid, and two assembled toy bugs from the cootie game, posed like they were either fighting or mating. The rain was still coming down hard outside, but the window curtains that could have come from an antebellum mansion muffled the roar of the storm. The last room in the railroad flat was Bob's bedroom, most of it taken up by a four-poster bed. "I can never move out of this place. It would take me years to pack," Bob called from the kitchen, only 8 feet away. "Turn on the radio, would you?" "If I can find it," Sue said, and heard his laugh in response. She had to focus out so much clutter, like she was in a lost and found, forgotten by time, until she saw it. The radio was a blonde wood-paneled box as big as an ice chest, with circular knobs like thick poker chips, and four lines of numbers for different frequencies. She turned the on-off volume until its satisfying cock was so loud Bob heard it from the kitchen. "The tubes have to warm up," he said. "Does this get shortwave from the Soviet Union?" "How do you know?" "My grandma had a radio like this." "So did mine. In fact, that's it." Bob came in with a tray on which were two cups, a pitcher of milk, a sugar bowl with a painted honeybee on the lid, and a plate stacked with Oreo cookies. "Feel free to take off your coat unless you like being damp." Orchestral music played from the radio just as the tea kettle sounded its harmonic toot. Sweet tea with milk, three Oreos, and Bob Roy's snug and cozy flat helped Sue breathe deeply for the first time in months. She let out a sigh as big as a cresting wave and leaned back into a chair so soft it put the Z in cozy. "Okay," Bob said. "Tell me everything." She opened up about, well, everything, cued by Bob's sympathy. He uttered his support at every story, every anecdote. New York was the only place for Sue to be. Shelley and her "yeah, okay" attitude were to be expected from such a "see you next Tuesday." The subway was survivable as long as you never made eye contact with anyone. You found an apartment by reading the rental classifieds in the Times and the Village Voice, but you had to get them early, at 7 a.m, and then you had to hightail it to the apartments with a bag of donuts, because the super would always open up for a pretty girl who shared her donuts. From there, they moved back in time, reminiscing about the summer seasons at Arizona, comparing the backstage gossip to that from the front office, the love affairs gone horrible, and how Sue thought Monty Hall was a solid professional. Bob spilled his tea, laughing. "Have you had any lunch?" "No. I was going to treat myself to a slice of pizza pie." That $0.50 per wedge pizza had become Sue's standby meal at midday. "Let me go out for deli. You strip out of that uniform of yours and take a hot bath. I'll leave you a robe I stole from a spa in the desert. Then we'll eat like middle-class Jews." In the kitchen, he removed a large butcher board that covered the bathtub. Why a tub was in the kitchen had something to do with the original plumbing of the old building. He turned on the water, so hot plumes of steam hazed the security-gated window, and laid the robe across a chair. A delicate wicker basket held scented soap, shampoo, conditioner, an organic sponge, and a pitcher to fill with water and rinse with. "I'll take my time. You soak." Bob locked two of the front door locks behind him. After the week abbreviated showers uptown, Sue relished the feel of hot water on her skin and the pouring of water over her head. It was funny taking a bath in a kitchen like this. But she was alone. The bath was like the hot tub on the Glebe family patio, and Sue scrubbed, rinsed, and soaked her way to being truly, wonderfully clean. She was still soaking when the front door locks were opened, and Bob returned carrying a large bag of deli. "Still naked, I see." Bob didn't bother averting his eyes, and Sue didn't mind. If backstage was no place for modesty, as they said in the theater, Bob Roy's kitchen was no place for blushing. Sue's now pale limbs were swimming in the man-sized terry cloth robe as she sat at the coffee table, running a comb through her damp hair. Bob set down some half-sandwiches, small cartons of soup, coleslaw, pickle wedges, and cans of what was called seltzer, and over lunch they talked about movies and plays. Bob said he could get her free tickets to the lousy shows on Broadway and cheap seats for the hits, so there would be no more evenings in New York with nothing to do but be unpopular on Rebecca's couch. He'd call around to friends for tips on agents who could arrange a meeting or two, no promises beyond that. He knew a few rehearsal pianists who would help with her audition numbers, with sheet music, transpose for her key. "Okay, Titmouse," Bob said, clapping rye crumbs from his fingers. "Let me see this resume of yours." She pulled the old version out of her purse as Bob grabbed a pencil. After a quick once-over, he drew a big X on the paper with a sigh. "Standard. So standard." "What's wrong with it?" Sue was hurt. She had worked hard on the thing. Her stage career was on that piece of paper. All the plays she had done in high school, including the one-acts, asterisked with Thespian Society Award. Every performance she had ever given at the ACLO, from member of the chorus right up to last year's turn as Nellie Forbush in South Pacific. 5 seasons, and 18 musicals. The productions at the Gas Lamp Playhouse Dinner Theater, Emily in Our Town, and the ensemble in Zoo Story. The narration she did for the Diabetes Walkathon public service message. Every performance Sue Glebe had ever given was listed on that resume. As we jaded queens say, nobody gives a shit, honey. Bob stood up and went into his bedroom. From under his bed, he pulled out an old typewriter, protected by a clear plastic dust cover. This beast is so heavy, I really should keep it out. Make space on the table, would you? Sue moved away the deli leftovers and a stack of books. Bob's typewriter was nearly as big as his grandmother's radio, a black metal antique fitting for an apartment crammed with old, peculiar things. The typewriter was a royal, with glass sections on the sides, like opera windows for any titmouse that might take up residence among the keys. "Does that still work?" Sue asked. "It's a typewriter, child. Ribbon, oil, paper, happy fingers. That's all it needs. This, however..." He disdainfully picked up the record of Sue's life's work, holding it with two fingers like it was rancid melon rind. Then he grabbed a pencil and used it as a pointer. "You list only the roles you've played, not the high school you went to or the gas bag amateur playhouse diner. The only pro credit you have is the Arizona CLO, so you can't lie about those credits. You put it at the top in big capital letters, then list the best plays and the best roles first, not in the order you performed them. If you were in the chorus, name your part like Ellen Cramore or Candy Beaver toward the bottom. If anyone questions you, then you say you were in the chorus. These other roles, in high school and all that, yes, they go under the heading regional theater. Embellish. Don't tell them the plays were one acts. Don't tell them you won any trophies. Don't tell them they only ran 2 weekends. The play, the role. You were a working actress in the region of Pile of Rocks, Arizona, and you have the credits to prove it." "Isn't that lying?" "They don't care." Bob took his pencil to the resume again. "Oh, look, you've done commercials. Valley Furniture, Disease of the Month. No, no, no. You put right here, commercials on request. They will see that you have done commercials, but will request not a single one." "Really?" "Trust Bobby Roy, Sue. The great ones all do. Now, this last bit, this sad paragraph listing your special skills. This is bullshit to anyone on the other side of the casting desk. Notice, I did not say couch. What if they're looking for special skills? They ask you. But this list? Guitar. You know 3 chords, right? You can juggle. 3 oranges for a few seconds, right? You roller skate. What kid doesn't? You can ski and ride a bike and skateboard. BFD. Did you actually put sign language here? I learned some for Tribal Heritage Day. This means awkward. Bob gave the one bit of sign language he knew. This means bullshit. Understand that your resume will receive all of 5 nanoseconds of attention. Casting people look at your picture, then at you to see if it matches. Are you actually a girl? Do you have blonde hair? You sporting a rack of any significance? If you're what they are looking for, they turn over to your resume, scan your credits and your lies, then scribble down this magic word. Call back. Bob rolled paper into the old royal, adjusted the margins and tabs, and within minutes had typed out a crisp, clear, and clean resume that made Sue look like she was as experienced a dreamer as ever hopped a bus to the big city. She could boast of 30 roles. The one thing missing from the paper was her name at the top. "Let's think about this for a moment," Bob said. "Over more tea." He removed the deli tray to the kitchen and lit another big match for the burner. "I'd get out more Oreos, but then we just eat them." "Think about what?" Sue studied her new professional call sheet. She liked herself more because of what Bobby had typed. "Have you ever thought of changing your name?" "My real name is Susan Noreen Glebe. I've always been just Sue." Joan Crawford had always been Lucy LeSueur. Leroy Shearer was called Junior till he became Rock Hudson. "You ever hear of Franny Gum?" "Who?"
Bob sang the opening lines of Over the Rainbow.
Judy Garland? Pal of Francis lacks the panache of Friend of Dorothy, doesn't it?
My parents will be disappointed if I don't use my real name.
Disappointing your parents is the first thing to do when you come to New York.
When the kettle sounded off, Bob refilled the teapot sitting beside the Royal.
And say you make it big on the Great White Way, which you will. Do you really want to see that name in lights? Sue Glebe?
Sue blushed, not out of embarrassment at such praise, but because, deep inside her, she knew she had a future as an actress. She wanted to be big, yes, as big as Francis Gum. Bobby poured more tea into both cups.
And how do you pronounce that? Glebe? Glebe? Glibe?
He pantomimed a big, fake yawn.
You know what Tammy Grimes' stage name was?
Tammy Grimes, he fake yawned even wider.
How about Susan Noreen?
Sue could imagine that name up in lights, no problem.
Bob flicked the paper in the Royal typewriter, snapping the new resume with his finger. This is a birth certificate for the new Sue. If you could go back in time and pick a brand new name for yourself and your ma and pa, what would that name be?
Elizabeth St. John? Marilyn Connor Bradley? Holly Woodenvine?
I can call myself something like that.
We'll check with the union, but yes.
Who do you want to be, Titmouse?
Sue held her tea. There was a name she'd once dreamed of having in junior high school when she sang in a folk group for her chapter of young life. Everyone was making up groovy names like Rainbow Spirit Chaser. She came up with hers, imagining the name on the cover of her first LP.
Joy Makepeace, she said it out loud.
Bobby's face showed no reaction.
Keep big trouble with that on smoke signal, he said, unless you have some Native American DNA in the Glebe bloodline.
So it went as the afternoon wore on. Bobby came up with a constant stream of stage names, the best of which was Susanna Woods, the worst being Cassandra O'Day. The Oreos had come back out and were now all eaten.
Sue kept working the joy angle. Joy Friendly, Joy Rourke, Joy Lovecraft,
Joy Spilled Milk, Bobby said. Sue used the bathroom. Even Bobby's water closet was replete with estate sale booty. She could not imagine why anyone would want a toy bowling set with Fred Flintstone tin pens. Yet there they were. When she came out, Bobby was holding a stack of vintage picture postcards from Paris. They had considered French names like Joan of Arc, Yvette, Babette, and Bernadette, but none of those sang out. Bobby held one of the cards. He showed it to Sue. The Rue Saint-Honoré, pronounced Honoré. That's the masculine. The feminine has an extra E on the end, and is pronounced the same. Honoré. Isn't that lovely?
I'm not French.
Well, we could try an Anglo-Saxon surname, something simple, one syllable, Bates, Church, Smythe, Cook. And none of those are good. Sue flipped through the stack of old postcards. The Eiffel Tower, Notre Dame, Charles de Gaulle.
Honoré Good.
Bob repeated the name and liked the sound of it. Ease on the ends of both.
They'd call me Honoré Goody Two-Shoes.
No, they wouldn't. Everyone pretends they speak French, mon petit mouse.
Honoré Good is honestly good.
He reached over and pulled a black princess model phone off a bookshelf and dialed the number. I have a friend at Equity. They have a computer so no names get duplicated. Jane Fonda, Faye Dunaway, Raquel Welch, taken.
Raquel Glebe. My parents would have no problems with that.
Bob was connected to his friend Mark. Marky, Mark-a-lot, Bob Roy.
I know. It has?
Not since she went out of town on that cruise liner.
It's good money. Can you do me a little service?
Check the database for a stage name.
No, for one not taken.
Last name Good with an E on the end. First name Honoré. He spelled it out. With an accent or schwa or whatever on the first E. Sure, I'll hold.
I don't know, Bobby.
Sue was running the new name over and over again in her head. You can decide when you march into equity with your first contract and a check for the dues. Then you can be Sue Glebe or Catwoman Zelkowitz. But I have to tell you. Someone came on the phone, but it wasn't Bob's friend. Yes, I'm holding for Mark. Thank you. He turned back to Sue. I walked into that run-through of Brigadoon. Up there on stage was a girl playing Fiona who was going to have a career. Sue smiled and blushed. She was that Fiona. She had crushed that role, her first out of the chorus. Her Fiona had led to all the roles the ACLO had given her, had pushed her off to NYC, and had made her clean in Bob Roy's kitchen tub. I loved that girl, Bob said. I loved that actress. She wasn't some bitter leading lady pissed off that New York had had enough of her, or a painted starlet doing civic light opera because the distance and makeup hid the fact she was 43 years old. That Fiona was no mutton.
No, she was a local lamb, an Arizona gal who could hold the stage like a Barrymore, sing like Julie Andrews, with a set of boobs that set the boys aflutter.
If you had introduced yourself to me as Honoré Good, I would have said, well, you certainly are. But no, you were Sue Glebe. I thought, Sue Glebe? That's just not going to fly. Sue Glebe felt warm inside. Bobby Roy was her biggest fan, and she loved him. If he had been 15 years younger, 40 pounds lighter, and not a homosexual, she would have spent the night in his bed. Maybe she would, regardless. Mark came back on the phone. Are you sure? Bob asked. That spelling with an E? Okay, thanks, Marco. I will. Thursday? Why not? Bye. He hung up the phone, tapping it with his running fingers, and said, big decision time, Titmouse. Sue leaned back in her overstuffed chair. The rain had stopped outside. Her skin had been dried by the terry cloth of the robe, and she smelled of delicate rose water from the bath soap. The big radio was softly playing an orchestration of a nightclub standard, and for the first time ever, New York City seemed like the place Sue Glebe belonged. Exactly 1 year later. Who's who in the cast? Honoré Good, Miss Wentworth. Ms. Good trained at the Arizona Civic Light Opera. She was nominated for an Obie last year for her role as Kate Brunswick in Joe Runyon's Backwater Blues. This marks her Broadway debut. She thanks her supportive parents and Robert Roy Jr. for making it all possible. A special weekend. It was the early spring of 1970, and because his 10th birthday was in a week and a half, Kenny Stahl, still thought of as the baby of the family, did not have to go to school. He was going to be picked up by his mother around noon to spend a special weekend with her. So he came to the breakfast table in his ordinary, non-school clothes. His older brother, Kirk, and older sister, Karen, both in their uniforms for St. Philip Neri School, thought the deal was unfair. They wanted their mom to come and pick them up, too, to take them away, out of the house they had been moved into, to live again in Sacramento or any place else as long as they were the only kids, and the dark moodiness of their father and the constant sunny practicality of his second wife would not make their lives an emotional teeter-totter. Kenny's three stepsisters were 17, 15, and 14 years old. His stepbrother had 2 years on him. None of them had opinions as to the fairness of the birthday plan. They had always lived together in Iron Bend, attended the unified public schools, and never had to wear uniforms. This weekend didn't strike them as interesting, notable, or in any way special. The small house they all lived in was far out of town on Webster Road, closer to Molinas than to Iron Bend, which was the county seat, and where Kenny's father was head cook at the Blue Gum Restaurant. Eucalyptus trees,